This audio recording is under copyright protection. All rights reserved. Any duplication, transmission, or broadcast without permission is strictly prohibited by U.S. and international laws.
Well, then I will commence with a lengthy and tedious introduction to my friend, Andrew Kern. I met Andrew Kern 2 years ago in Houston, and it became very evident right off that this was going to be a problem relationship because we sat down at a table and had been told by our mutual friend, Martin Cawthorn of Memorial Press, that we should definitely meet each other. And the first thing I was disturbed at is the fact that he pretty much knew all my jokes. I made some effort to tell a joke, and he knew it right there, and he knew my next joke, but then I was vindicated because I knew his joke. So we realized that we were both extremely well-educated people, having known pretty much all the jokes there are to know. And then it also became apparent that we were very like-minded in many ways. We were sitting at a table at this conference in Houston. Someone walked up and asked a question, and since we're both named Andrew, we both answered the question at the same time. But that wasn't such a problem because we pretty much said the same thing. So I quickly realized that I was in the presence of a very great man. And over the past 2 years, we have gotten to be very close. We have traveled and done some workshops together. We called it the Two Andrews on Writing and Teaching Writing. We did Texas first, and then Florida, and then California, which pretty much covers all the high population areas of the country. We're thinking about the South, aren't we? We've got some dates blocked off to do places like Atlanta and South Carolina. So you'll get notified about that because we will desperately need you to sign up and bring your friends. But it's been a tremendous joy, and I have compared our seminars to kind of like this. Andrew, when he talks, he kind of comes down from heaven. He just kind of descends on your mind and your heart, and it's a transcendental experience. When I then come up and talk, I kind of come up from below. And so we meet in the middle, but when I actually do grow up, if that ever happens, I want to be like Mr. Andrew Kern, but it is difficult because he is younger than I am. And so I'm probably never going to catch up. But let's give a warm welcome to Mr. Andrew Kern.
Good morning. How do you thank somebody who takes you out of an orphanage, metaphorically, and gives you a role in his own life and mentors you while you're driving around in the car and relieves you of the duty of ever having to sing? I can't even begin to express my appreciation to Andrew Pudua for what he's done for me in the last couple of years. And in particular, well, I won't say in particular, but one special way that's worth mentioning now is the fact that he's allowing me to address you, and that in the room behind us where we have to carry all the boxes elsewhere, he's actually allowing the Searcy Institute to carry the Lost Tools of Writing here. And, you know, that's pretty tangible. That's pretty serious to me. That's a high praise and high honor from Andrew. And so I want to thank you, and Julie, thank you for not stopping him. And thanks to all of you. This is really a tremendous honor. You know, I really do believe that we're in a crisis point in our history as a people. I believe that our freedoms are, in many ways, they have been eroding for a long time. But it may be that we're about to fall off that cliff we've been wondering about for a long time. And I believe that I don't want to overstate this, so I'll just put it modestly. I believe the only hope for America is the classical homeschooling movement and the private schools, the parents, the moms who are taking on the education of their own children. I mean, you know, I just confused that whole point, so let me clarify it. What I really mean is the homeschooling mom is the last best hope for the world. And, you know, you look at, I've just offended a number of teachers in schools, so I want to explain what I mean by that. There are great things happening in private Christian schools, tremendously great things. But where the immediate accountability and feedback takes place is when you teach your own children. And where the innovation and the exploration and the courage to try something completely new, that's in the homeschooling mom and dad who is refusing. And think about this in the 80s. How many of you were homeschooling in the 80s? Thank you so much. Let's give them a hand. When did you all get out of prison? These people were pioneers for us. They were breaking down barriers. They were getting laws established. They were not necessarily legal in what they were doing. And now we have a cultural transformation taking place in American education because of the innovation that took place in the 80s in the homeschool. Don't forget that. You know, when the homeschool students started getting into Harvard, then they started to get a little bit of permission from their neighbors, you know, to continue. But there was a different value, a different pursuit. And for some people, it was perhaps fear. Perhaps it was, I'm afraid of what the culture will do to my children. Well, sometimes fear is a sensible thing. And sometimes it leads you to a positive movement. And so for many people, it became how can I actually bring my child to maturity? How can I keep them from being conformed to all the kids around them? You see? And so over the last 25 years, we have literally had the beginnings, I'd like to think, potentially of a cultural renewal in a very quiet, typically American grassroots way, haven't we? And so what's happening in the private schools now is being affected because of what happened 20 years ago in the homeschools. I wonder what could have happened, for example, in the classical movement of which I'm a part, if the homeschoolers hadn't embraced it. If Susan Wise Bauer, for example, hadn't written her book, which has sold something over 100,000 copies now, think of that. We are literally, very possibly, at the birth of a renaissance in our culture. Think of that. So here we are, poised on a knife's edge. Are we going to fall off a cliff, or are we going to be reborn as a culture? I believe the answer to that question depends on the courage of the American teacher. And so I want to talk to you this morning about this question, how to cultivate wisdom through writing. Now, I read this title yesterday closely for the first time, thinking how the reader might read it instead of how how it was intended, and I realized that it could mean something quite the contrary to what I initially thought. So let me ask you all a question. What does this title mean to you? How do you take it? Just think for a moment. And I know, I want to give you two tips before I get going here, that if I were lying on my deathbed and could only give one last tip to a teacher, this is what it would be. Ask a specific question of a specific student. Okay? In other words, never ask general questions. It freezes them. Okay? But, and then if you ask a specific question of a specific student, then a discussion will begin that will carry on until you stop asking specific questions of specific students, and in the end, everybody gets educated. The second tip I would have for you is take your time. So I'm going to break both of those tips or principles right now and ask you a very general question. And I'm going to ask all of you this general question so that we can all have a moment of silence during which we'll be forced to take our time, you see. And that is, how do you take this title, How to Cultivate Wisdom Through Writing? What does it mean to you? Since I know a couple names, if I know your name, beware, I might call on you. But otherwise, does anybody want to venture a hypothesis? Or forget that. I don't want to know what you think it means to me. I want to know, what does it mean to you? Does anybody have a take on this? Yes.
You allow yourself to think as you write and watch your ability to think progress.
Ah, I like that. You allow yourself to think as you write, and then you watch your ability to think progress because you're allowing it to happen. Okay? That's an interesting thought, isn't it? That you have to allow yourself to think while you write. It makes one wonder, what are kids normally required to do when they write, if they're not allowed to think? Good, thank you. That's very helpful. Anybody else? What is, when you maybe you only just saw the title, But looking at the title, what do you then expect from the workshop? Yes.
It's a kind of filtering process. Aha. Uh-huh. A lot of input, but that wisdom comes from making those choices.
Choices, filtering.
What's important to you as a person and what's going to bring you further the mission of this world, and that's what you get down on paper because you can't possibly write anything that's going on.
Yeah, good. So she's saying that when we're thinking, there's all this input we get, but then we have to make choices. We have to filter it. And that filtering helps us to fulfill our mission in life. Did I accurately represent? So there's a filtering process. Not just allowing yourself to think is crucial, and that's going to collect a lot of information, but then there's also this process of filtering, isn't there? Of making choices, of making judgments, we might say. Now, that's a bad word, of course, but can you be wise without making judgments? I haven't been able to judge a way to do that yet. Yes?
Cultivating is a farming word.
Ah,
right?
Good.
So you're taking something, the seed of wisdom, but then you're trying to cultivate that. You're trying to nurture it, encourage it, and the farming machinery you're going to use is right.
So all right. I like that. So she's pointing out that cultivating is a farming term, and that you plant the seed of wisdom, and then to cultivate it, to help it to grow, the farming equipment that you're using is writing. I like that. That's very good. Metaphorical thinking there. Yes, you're going to have to shout.
Me?
Yes. Yes.
And then they're going to have to weed it once they're done. And it's a very difficult process. And but it becomes worth it. And if we're really growing wisdom, what an amazing plant that would be. And it's worth the dirty work.
Any questions? You hate to hit the high point and then keep going, right? Wow, thank you. Yes.
I'll bounce off what she just said about gardening. She hates weeding. I garden. But the problem with weeding is if you try to do it all at one time.
Ah.
And so what you have to do is I go out and I spend an hour and a half every morning in the cool of the day.
Uh-huh.
So I choose a time to do it, and then I pluck my weeds. And the same thing is true with writing and teaching students. Wisdom of writing is you have to teach them about themselves. When is the best time for them to weed their
good.
Garden of writing?
Good. Can everybody hear that? That weeding is something you do in the cool of the day. And it's the same with the student. We nowadays talk about learning teaching moments. I guess there's a lot of other time in the classroom that aren't teaching moments. And so during those opportune moments when the climate is right, when the temperature is right, that's when you do the weeding. By the way, the soil also has a lot to do with weeding. If you practice square foot gardening and you make your own mix, you won't have any weeds, but that's beside the point right now.
I think it's what you're going to talk about is the process of attaining truth through writing.
The process of attaining truth through writing.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You can do that? Yeah.
About truth and think about what Andrew said.
What did Andrew say?
He was talking about the program has its foundation in truth.
Right.
Why it's so effective.
Right. So there's by learning to write, we're moving them toward perceiving the truth. Okay? Or we can at least move them toward perceiving the truth. Yes, in the back by the picture. To affect change. That's what our president's doing. Okay. Oh. What are you getting at? So, So now, when you say affect change, you know, we live in an age that's always talking about change, right? Remember, I remember the Clinton-Gore campaign. It was all, it's time for a change, it's time for a change. And then we got 8 years of change and then eight more years of change. And so then Obama needed to give us change we can believe in. But what are you talking about when you talk about change? What do you mean? Where?
In our culture.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you're talking about cultural change.
Yeah.
Okay, so what writing can do then is not only the students can be changed by learning to write, but then when they write,
oh, absolutely.
They can...
We're seeing that now, but kind of in the reverse.
Yeah, I don't think I'd be quite that negative. I think we're seeing both. We're seeing a good tension right now. I was really surprised, for example... There's a book I want to recommend to you on the Constitution that the Heritage Foundation put out recently. It's called Handbook on the Constitution, I think. And there's an introduction, and I believe it's written by Ed Meese. Do you all remember Ed Meese from the Reagan years? And in it, he says that in the 90s and the 80s, the general approach to the Constitution was what we always hear about in the popular media, that it's a living document, all that sort of thing. But during the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of people arguing for the Constitution and original intent. Right? There were a lot of people who argued for that. And according to Ed Meese, this very much surprised me, in the modern courts around America, in the schools, the general view of the Constitution is that you need to find out the original intent. That's quite an accomplishment. That's a potential cultural, political cultural transformation. If it can slow down the onslaught of change. So do not for a moment think that there's only one side winning this battle. There is truly a cultural, spiritual, political war taking place. But it's got two sides fighting for it. And I think, again, I think the homeschool mom is the superhero in this war. This is what I wanted to read to you from the book of Proverbs. Chapter 5. My son... Attend unto my wisdom, and bow thine ear to my understanding, that thou mayest regard discretion, and that thy lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of a strange woman drop as an honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil, but her end is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps take hold on hell. Lest thou shouldest ponder the path of life, her ways are movable, that thou canst not know them. Okay, that last verse in particular I want you to notice. Lest thou shouldest ponder the path of life, her ways are movable, that thou canst not know them. If you were to pay attention, which I'm sure you've all done in varying degrees, to the public presentation of, what can we call it, of prudence, of wisdom, what the world around us, what the mainstream media, as we like to call it, what the general sense, certainly the academic institutions in America, what they regard as smart, as the right thing to do. Have you ever noticed how movable it is? How it keeps shifting? And the justification is always there's this pendulum moving back and forth. Look, if there's a pendulum moving back and forth, it's the one that Edgar Allan Poe writes about and we're lying under it. Okay? There is not a pendulum that goes back and forth between right and left. If it does, it's like this. Right? It's not just that there's these two forces moving back and forth. There's a movability, there's a changeability to this false woman. And I suspect you probably have noticed that in the book of Proverbs there's two women that keep popping up. Right? Proverbs 31 is this excellent woman, this virtuous woman. Throughout the book of Proverbs, he's giving us these two alternatives. The one woman is wisdom, and the other woman is folly. And what is folly compared to? Anybody know? What is folly consistently compared to? I heard voices, but I didn't hear. Yeah, a prostitute. A harlot. A whore. Listen to these words again. The lips of a strange woman. Strange in the old-fashioned English sense. Alien. Not weird, strange. Unknown. Right. What was that?
Unfamiliar.
I'm sorry?
A stranger.
Unfamiliar, a stranger. An unknown woman. And here's the description. The lips of a strange woman drop as an honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil, but her end is bitter as wormwood. Is there anything more obvious than that there are sirens all around us singing to us? Every culture knows that. Everybody knows that we're constantly being tempted. But notice this. The lips of a strange woman drop as an honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil, but her end is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps take hold on hell. And then the practical application. Lest thou shouldest ponder. Please notice that word. Ponder the path of life. Lest thou shouldest ponder the path of life. Her ways are movable. If you get absorbed in following the path of folly, and of course he's writing to his son, so he puts this in terms of what the whole thing's metaphorical, but lest you should ponder the path of life, she keeps moving. She keeps changing. She's addicted to change. She can't stand stability. She's directing you one way and you think this is the way to go, and then as soon as you're about to get where you think you're going to arrive, she moves the path on you. This is what folly does. Her ways are movable. And because they're moving all the time, you're distracted. You feel like you're in a tornado or a hurricane. You can't find the eye of the storm. You're constantly driven to figure out, where am I? Where am I? Where am I? And you cannot. You cannot, because of that, you cannot ponder the perfectly still, unmovable, eternal path of life. So you can't know anything. That's the American school. It's a school run by harlots. Now that was nasty. That was a very cruel sounding thing. So I have to clarify that I'm also speaking metaphorically, and that I have a basis for it in history. And I'm not trying to say that everybody who teaches, for example, in the public school is a harlot, okay? I think that many, many Christians ought to teach in the public schools. It may even be because I'm not fit to judge anybody else's. Nobody in this room is my servant, right? So if, for example, anybody in this room puts their children in the public school, I have nothing whatsoever to say against that because you're not my servant. It's not up to me to judge that. It's between you and your God. So it may well be that many Christian kids should be in the public schools. However, if you put your children in the public school, or if you put yourself in the public school, and now I have to say the hard part, if you put your children in a private school, or if you yourself are teaching in a private school, if you teach your children at home, you need to be aware that the way we do education in the modern world isn't Christian. Okay? It isn't the path of life. It is the path of folly. And I don't mean that every single person everywhere walks the path of folly. What I'm saying is that there are basic ideas that undergird American education today, permeate the state schools and the private schools, and much of what I'm seeing in the homeschool market, and they're Darwinian, They're naturalistic, materialistic, and ultimately, therefore, my perspective being Christian, I see them as being coming from the enemy. I see them as the ever-changing path of folly. And they are, listen, they are preventing our children from pondering the path of life. I have asked many times, I do teacher training, I go into schools and do teacher training, private and charter. And I've asked many times in my teacher training sessions, I've asked how many of you teachers have been trained in the teachers' colleges? And then I follow up with this question. While you were in teachers' college, how much time did you spend thinking about how to cultivate wisdom and virtue in the children? I get a range of answers from sad laughter to something approaching anger. I've never once encountered a teacher, and I'm welcoming of a correction on this. I have never once encountered a teacher who learned in teacher's college how to cultivate wisdom and virtue in a child. Which is another way of saying, I've never once met a teacher who is trained in teacher's college how to guide a student to ponder the path of life. That hurts me to say that. This is not meant to be a personal assault on teachers' colleges or teachers' college professors. This is an appeal. This is a cry from the heart. We aren't pondering the path of life. Now, for the context, for context on what writing has to do with this, I do want to tell you a story. I want to give you a narrative from American education history. But before I do, I want to give you a definition. Definitions are the most boring part of any speech. So let me give you this definition. Write this down, and then I want you to use this definition to compare it to what's happening, what has happened is happening in American schools, public, private, and forgive me, home. Okay. Here's the definition. Education is the cultivation of wisdom and virtue. Education is the cultivation of wisdom and virtue. Just a comment. If that's what education is, and if that's not what they're teaching teachers how to do in teachers' college, then they're not teaching teachers how to teach. Education is the cultivation of wisdom and virtue. And how do we do that? By nourishing the soul. By nourishing the soul. You see, the soul is the seed of wisdom and virtue. You might say it's the soil in which you need to plant the seeds of wisdom and virtue. It's the soul that can become wise and virtuous, not the body, which I'm going to come back to in a moment. By nourishing the soul. And what does the soul need? What does a healthy soul feed on? If plants need light and water and dirt, what does the soul need? I would suggest to you that it needs truth. Have you ever noticed how much more healthy an honest soul is than a dishonest? It needs truth. It also needs goodness. Give a child a full heaping doses of goodness, and his soul will feed on it. And it needs beauty. The soul needs truth, it needs goodness, and it needs beauty. Which is exactly why God made a creation overflowing with beauty and goodness and truth. The beauty of holiness. You want to see it? Look at the sky. Look at the grass. Look at the trees. Look at the garden. You know, God put Adam, the first man, in a garden because it was beautiful, because it was good, and because if he took care of that garden, he would be better able to understand the truth. So we nourish the soul on the truth, goodness, and beauty. But here's the great thing. What I've just said, Plato would have said that. Okay, Aristotle would have said that. And I like them for that. But I don't think they go high enough. Because as believers in the one holy God, we can add something pretty magnificent to that. As believers in the incarnate Logos, we can add this to that. So that we nourish the soul on truth, goodness, and beauty. So that in Christ, the student. Now, your hand might start shaking as you write this because it's pretty amazing. This is a little overwhelming. This is what your child can do. Ready for this? So that in Christ, the student is better able to know God, to glorify God, and to enjoy Him forever. To enjoy Him forever. So that in Christ, the student is better able to know God, to glorify God, and to enjoy Him forever. Do you understand that the faculties your child was born with are God-given? And do you understand why God gave them to him? I'll tell you why God gave your child the gifts that he gave him. So they could get into college and make a lot of money. What, that's not it? Look, if that's what you want, you can equip your children to that end. And they could be mega successful in this world. But if you do that, you're trading in your birthright for a bowl of pottage. Because our Lord promised us that if we seek first the kingdom of God and His justice, His righteousness, that all those other things would be added to us. If we seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, then not only do we see our culture transformed bit by bit by bit, not in an aggressive way, not in a way of us imposing our will on it, but in a way that sees souls all around us awakening to the beauty of holiness and wanting it because it's so good, not because it's imposed on them. But not only do we see this cultural transformation, but we see souls which last a lot longer than the culture. Did you know that? This culture's temporary, but your child's soul is going to last forever. Invest in the child's soul. That's primary. All the other stuff follows. But you will see in your child an increased capacity to enjoy God. He gave him the faculties he gave him or her so that they could enjoy God. Do you remember the movie Chariots of Fire? Don't you just love that scene where the very just and pious missionary girl is saying, "Stop running, we've got work to do. What you're doing isn't spiritual enough." And Eric Liddell says, "God made me to run. He made me to run fast. And He didn't make me to speak with a Scottish accent." And listen, when I run, I feel His pleasure. When I run, I feel His pleasure. That is why God gave us our gifts and our talents and our abilities. When we use them, when we take the faculties that He breathed into us, when we cultivate them, when we become good at what He made us good at, we feel His pleasure. It's this little hint of a well done echoing around in our minds. Well done. Well done. Practice. That is what you can educate your children toward. But I need to tell you a story. In 1859, a book came out that often is it's said changed the world. What it did was it took a lot of movable things and gave them a single point of reference to justify them and oppose opposition. And that book is called On the Origin of Species. Now, to understand the impact of On the Origin of Species, I'm going to suggest to you that the really important thing about this book is not evolutionary theory. The really important thing is actually explained most clearly by a man named John Dewey. Ever hear of John Dewey? John Dewey had a lot of really good ideas, but they were movable. Undergirding all of his ideas is this statement in his essay, very short essay, about 10 pages long in a Word document, called On the Impact of Darwinism Upon Education. This is the opening sentence. When Charles Darwin wrote his book On the Origin of Species, everybody knew that a scientific revolution had taken place. But what even the experts failed to see was that an intellectual revolt had occurred, which introduced a new intellectual temper. An intellectual revolt had occurred, which introduced a new intellectual temper. You and I today are living in the wake, in both senses of that word, of that intellectual revolt. We're living in the wake of that intellectual revolt. And we have, you and I have, that new intellectual temper. You and I think with these new minds. This, in fact, I was reading yesterday in some article, I forget where, the modern scientific mind. Okay, and it was, by the way, giving it high praise. The modern scientific mind doesn't think the way the pre-modern, unscientific mind thought. The new intellectual temper follows on an intellectual revolt. Now, what is this intellectual revolt that supposedly occurred according to John Dewey? Now, let me just say very quickly, I think Dewey was wrong. I think that the intellectual revolt occurred in the 1600s, and that it was accomplished by men like Francis Bacon and René Descartes, but you don't want to go into all that now. Let's just talk briefly and concisely about what that intellectual revolt is. Because Dewey is very clear about what it is. It's a rejection of the Christian classical tradition. And it replaces the Christian classical tradition with what we can now very easily call the progressive tradition. In politics, we have the progressive parties, we have the progressive movement. In education, we have a complete stranglehold of progressivism over American education. To be certified as an American teacher is to be certified by a school that was accredited by NCATE, the National Council of American Teachers of Education. NCATE accredits the schools that certify the teachers, Christian or non-Christian, Hebrew, Muslim. If you're a certified teacher in America, you are certified by a school that was accredited by NCATE. NCATE is a progressive stronghold. In other words, if you're certified as a teacher in America, you are certified as a teacher who learned Darwinian methodologies for teaching, who had the modern intellectual temper formed into your mind so that then you could turn around and form students on that modern intellectual temper, which, as I've said, is a rejection of the Christian classical tradition. What's the difference? The difference, Dewey explains, is on that word, origin of those words, origin of species. It's in the title. Origin of species. The term species. Now I know it sounds a little technical here, but there's a big, huge difference between the old concept of species and the modern concept of species. According to Aristotle, who really developed this concept of, you know, we have genus and species in science, that really comes from Aristotle. A species is basically eternal. A horse is a horse. It's an equus. That's the, you know, we call it the equiline species. Okay, it's always going to be that. It never was anything other than that, and it never can be anything other than that. Species are unchangeable. They're eternal. But Darwin, according to Dewey, proved that, in fact, that's not the case. Species change to other things. Okay, so you can become something higher. Maybe you were a paramecium a few million years ago. Now you can be a human being. All right? Now, again, I'm not talking here about the biology of this. If you believe in something, nobody believes in Darwinian evolution anymore, but if you believe in the neo-Darwinian synthesis with genetics and all that, I'm not going to try to argue you out of that right now. But I am going to try to get you to think about the metaphysics of it. the philosophy behind it, the worldview of it. Because according to Dewey, Darwin proved that nothing, listen please, nothing is eternal. After all, if every species has an origin and will become something else, then what something is isn't what it will be for very long, in geological terms. Now, if that's true of mice, I don't care. But think about this for a moment. What if that's true of humans? Now, I'm going to argue from a specifically Christian perspective here. If that's true of humans, what does it tell us about the incarnate Logos? Are we going to be able to evolve beyond Christ? God become man? Look, when God became man, the Christian teaches that humankind, that humanity, listen, was brought into the Trinity. Sounds heretical, doesn't it? But it's not. It's from Athanasius and from the Church Fathers that defended the Trinity and were very explicit and clear about what the Trinity was teaching. Humankind, human nature, was brought into the Trinity. And if we accept that all things are constantly changing, then what we are saying is that even Christ himself, who, what does it say in Hebrews? Jesus Christ, the same, yesterday and today and forever. Therefore, if humankind is going to be evolved beyond, then that means that God is going to be evolved beyond, from the Christian perspective. What Dewey tells us is that Darwin introduces this intellectual revolt against everything eternal. And so what happens then is, now get this, what happens then is we get a new intellectual temper. And Dewey's very explicit on this. Those foolish Christians, the silly Jews, they were all hung up on permanent things. Eternal things. Things that last forever. Get over it. Nothing lasts forever. You can't even go on like Kansas and say like the earth and sky. Because even they don't last forever. Even the dust in the wind doesn't last forever. We're not even that. We're nothing. Everything is changing. Truth changes. What's good changes. What's beautiful changes, justice changes, the Constitution changes, everything changes. And that is the new intellectual temper. It's a temper that says, stop seeking the permanent. Just embrace change. Change is good. We need change, and we don't need to define it. We don't need to say what it is. We just need change. Let me take you back to that verse. Lest thou shouldest ponder the path of life, her ways are movable, that thou canst not know them. You can't know them. See, Dewey goes on. He takes it one step further. He tells us that we can't know anything. This is Dewey's definition of knowledge in this essay. Dewey says that knowledge is the adaptation of an organism to its environment. Knowledge is an adaptation of an organism to its environment. Okay? So, there isn't, please notice, there isn't a soul that is eternal. And there isn't any idea or thing outside your body that is eternal that can be known. You have a brain. Highly complex chemical processes take place in there. But it's constantly changing. There's no soul. Just a brain. And there's nothing outside your brain that doesn't change. There's just an ever, always changing world. Therefore, there's no knower and there's nothing to know. What there is an organism in an environment constantly trying to adapt. And knowledge, therefore, is the ability to adapt. His philosophy, therefore, is called pragmatism. It's not about knowing the truth. It's about adapting to the environment. Therefore, what's true for you is true for you, and what's true for me is true for me, because it helps me to adapt to the environment. It might mean that I have emotions that need to adapt to new changes. My girlfriend left me, so I have to adapt. It gets very complex with human beings, but it's all about adapting to the environment. There, and please let me say this as clearly as I can, there is no soul. There is nothing that can know, and there is nothing to know. That thou canst not know them. Constantly changing, so you can never know. Now, if there isn't a soul, and you're teaching a child, what are you not looking after? That's one of those really easy questions. The soul. Do you understand that the 20th century was a bold, very bold, I would call it an ignoble experiment to see if we could educate children and build a society without souls? We tried to build a political system that would deny the existence of a God. And by denying the existence of a God, we lose the image of God. By losing God, we lose man. And we put the child in a school, and they don't think about the soul. I think it was John Locke who wrote this phrase, "The soul is a needless hypothesis." That ought to be engraved in stone on the doorway of every school you enter almost in America. You ought to know this, right? That their way of approaching education, let me stop saying there, that ought to be written over a big chunk of our own minds, our own practices. Because we've got, do you understand? You and I, we've got this new intellectual temper. So much of what we do wouldn't be any different if our children didn't have souls. Stop to think about that. So much of the way we teach our children would be exactly the same if it turned out that they don't have any souls. So let's just carve it on the walls. The soul is a needless hypothesis. It has nothing to do with educating kids. But what if they do have a soul? What if they are the image of God? Let me suggest to you that there's two features or two qualities, two properties that the soul possesses that need to be cultivated. And I think as I say these two things, it'll sort of unfold like a rose maybe. It'll unfold for you how these things have been neglected and the price we're paying as a culture. If we have a soul, then we have two things that the modern world doesn't believe in. They use these words, but they've altered the meaning of them. We don't have a will. If we have a soul, we have a will. If we don't have a soul, we don't have a will. The will is free or it doesn't exist. Any will that is predetermined, that everything you do is predetermined, that's just naturalism. Okay, that's not the will. The will is a miracle. It's the image of God in us. It's the ability. I don't even know what the will is. It's something that enables us to rise above the animals. We don't just do things by instinct, do you see? A beaver builds a dam exactly the same today in 2010 AD as it did in 4005 BC. Every beaver dam exactly the same. No creativity, just instinct, just animal will, animal instinct. We, if we're going to build a dam, we can get creative. We can innovate. We can impose our will on that dam. Do you see? And intimately bound, and I can't find the line between them, intimately bound up with the will is reason. Reason. Now, the reason in the modern mind is Mr. Spock. Emotionless, cold, irrational. I mean, it is irrational, actually. Emotionless and cold. Very limited, and basically it's a calculator. Okay, that's modern reason. It's the ability to calculate quickly. reason in the Christian classical tradition is very different. For example, in the Symposium, we find out that what drives and sustains and is the goal of reason is love. It is love that causes us to reason. We learn in Aristotle that reason is symphonic. That reason, we even today we'll talk about rationalizing, right? We'll talk about, now rationalizing also has a new meaning. Rationalize now means to give a calculated defense of something you did wrong. But rationalizing historically meant that you take a number of disparate things and you bring them into a harmony. You see? Reason is symphonic. Mozart's music is rational music. Bach's music is rational music, and it'll break your heart because it's so rational. But we don't believe in the reason anymore. Now, what happens when you don't believe in the will and you don't believe in the reason is you don't cultivate them, right? Why would you cultivate something you don't believe exists? Therefore, when you teach a kindergarten child, and by the way, this whole talk has been directed primarily at kindergarten teachers. No, parents of one-year-olds. If you teach a one-year-old and you believe the child has a soul and has a will and has the faculties of reason, then you will teach that child differently than if you believe only that that child has appetites and senses. Right? If you believe the child has a will, what are you going to do with that will? What is your role as a parent if your child has a will? I'm seeing smiles. Tell me the word. Train it! Train it! Which is actually, by the way, a gardening term. Training doesn't come from sports. It comes from plants first and then was transferred to sports. You train up a child in the way that it should go, the way you train up a plant, the way that it should grow. And that will become strong and stable. That's what it means to train. It means, listen, to strengthen it from within. If you believe your child has a will, then you discipline the will. But if you believe the child is a bag of appetites, directed by the senses, in other words, like Hobbes taught, like Machiavelli taught, like the modern school teachers are taught, that you believe that the child is a stimulus response mechanism. He has desires, and you need to stimulate those desires, and then you can get the right behavior if you give the right responses to those stimulants, you see. If that's what you believe, then you're not going to discipline the will. You're going to be driven by entertaining this poor child. And you know what happens? The child becomes miserable and bored because you're killing him. Do you understand that? If you don't discipline your child, what does the scriptures tell us? It tells us you hate him. It tells us that you hate him. That's the Bible's words. In other words, as a culture, we hate children. Not just the unborn ones. We hate children. We're not willing to discipline their will. We also don't cultivate reason. We don't cultivate that faculty that can perceive the harmony of things. We don't cultivate the faculty that can make a consistent series of statements, that can avoid contradictions, both in behavior and in sentences. You see, we don't cultivate the rational faculty. We just get them to respond to stimulant. They won't do anything unless we give them a grade, right? Because certainly everybody knows children aren't interested in learning. So we have to add all these bells and whistles to it, right? I've found very differently. When you believe in a child's soul and you start teaching the child like it has a soul, it comes alive. And you see this capacity for thinking in any child. I'm talking about, I've seen this in kids with Down syndrome. I've seen this in kids with Asperger's. Any child, if you're willing to acknowledge that it's not just a chemical problem. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I said it's not just a chemical problem. There's a will and reason involved. And when you cultivate the reason, it comes alive. And it gets better and better at functioning. And all of a sudden, you realize that there's a human being here. You realize it's a human being, the image of God. And creativity, which is rational, you see. Creativity starts flowing out of the children, which, of course, will put you as a parent in a panic because you don't know how they're going to use it. So you have to direct it. You have to train it up. Fine. But please don't quench the Spirit. Don't take the amazing creativity that is natural to every child and be afraid of what it's going to do to your household and not let the child become creative. If they're 2.5 years old begging for a violin, if you possibly can, get them a violin. Maybe other people will learn how to write then. I want to appeal to you. Honor that image of God within your child, and when they're showing inclinations toward creativity, nurture and cultivate it, because that's the reason within them. That's that rational faculty. Now, I'm out of time. What do I have left for time? 20 minutes? Better get to my talk then. Okay. That was all introductory. Well, not so much introductory as context. I believe that we can, in fact, cultivate wisdom through writing. I believe that there are very practical day-to-day steps that we can take to actually cultivate the divine image, that the wisdom in our children. So how do we do that? To answer that question, I want to address three sub-questions. The first question is, what is wisdom? The second question is, what kinds of wisdom are there? And the third question is, how do we get wisdom, or how at least can we communicate wisdom to our children? How can we cultivate wisdom in our children? Well, first question, what is wisdom? And frankly, I have no idea, so let's go to the second question. Kinds of wisdom. All right, I'll suggest some definitions of wisdom that I've stolen from others. Aristotle had a definition that I find quite helpful. It's extremely concise, and it's going to surprise you how simple it is at first, but he says wisdom is the knowledge of causes. The knowledge of causes. I'll come back to that in just a moment. Thomas Aquinas gives a wonderful practical definition of wisdom. He says that the wisdom is the ability to order and to judge. He says it is the part of the wise man to order and to judge. So the wise has the ability to order and to judge. Order not in the sense of ordering people around, but order in the sense of putting things in the right place. Wendell Berry makes a comment about this when it comes to the artist. He says the artist is the one who knows what to put where and when to put it. What to put where and when to put it. And then here's a third definition. This is my groping attempt to come up with a definition I can understand. Wisdom is the ability to perceive the nature of things so as to know how to appropriately relate to them. Okay. Wisdom is the ability to perceive the nature of things so as to know how to appropriately relate to them. Wisdom is the ability to perceive the nature of things so as to know how to appropriately relate to them. And by the way, I need to take a moment to thank Cameron for helping me work my way to that one last night when he was trying hard to sleep. Any one of these could be a whole week's discussion in itself, or maybe a lifetime's contemplation. So let me leave those definitions with you. You can reflect on them and think about them, see if they work for you. And let's go on to talk about kinds of wisdom. I've identified, to the best of my ability, 5 levels of wisdom, and also Cameron helped me with this. The first is what I'm going to call mechanical wisdom. This is a very precise form of wisdom. If I'm driving along and I hear a thump in my car and I don't know what caused it, it's because I lack wisdom. I lack mechanical wisdom. I don't know the cause of that sound. On the other hand, if there's a mechanic sitting next to me, and he hears that sound and knows exactly what the cause is, then he can either say, just keep going, it's nothing, or he can say, pull the car over to the side of the road. See, because he's identified the causes, he knows the cause, he's able to order my behavior, he's able to judge what caused it, and he's able to order my behavior. Then he can get out of the car, walk around to the hood, open it up, and look inside the engine, and find the specific cause, and he can reorder things in the engine making judgments about what's working and what's not, and he can fix the engine. It's very precise. It's very exact. And it's a mechanical wisdom, which I have great respect for. The second wisdom is artistic wisdom. Artistic. The difference is that this is less precise. What we're looking at now is we're bringing in the law of propriety. Artistic wisdom, artistry, is governed by propriety. If you teach writing, which I'm guessing one or two of you do, you may have told your students at some point, there are no rules. I'm guessing that because you're using IEW, you wouldn't have said that, but sometime in your life, you may have said, there are no rules. That's almost right. There is one law, one uncompromisable governing principle for every art, and it's the law of propriety. If you ever do what doesn't fit, you have failed. As an artist, you have failed. And so we have less precision, right? With mechanical wisdom, it fixed the problem. With artistic wisdom, it's fitting, it's appropriate. And this is where, in the realm of artistic wisdom, this is where we begin to see creative human production. And it requires primarily discipline, and rising from that discipline comes insight. Okay? So this is artistic wisdom, less precise, has to do with human production, and it requires discipline. Now, mechanical wisdom is useful wisdom. It's practical wisdom. Okay? It gives us necessary, useful outcomes. It keeps the world oiled. It keeps the world lubricated. Artistic wisdom enables us to perceive beauty. And by the way, to create beauty. The next level of wisdom I want to suggest for you is ethical wisdom. This might sound odd at first, but ethical wisdom is even less precise than artistic wisdom. But it's still completely governed by the universal law of propriety. For example, why are we supposed to have only one God? Why are we supposed to worship only one God? Because it would be totally inappropriate to worship any other God. He's the only God worthy of worship. Any other God is beneath you. Think about that for a second. Any other God is beneath you. Only one God is above you and therefore worthy of worship. And so why shouldn't we steal? Because it's inappropriate. Do you see? So even ethical wisdom is governed by the principle of propriety. But now, rather than talking about creative human production, we're talking about human action. And the goal of this wisdom, the outcome of this form of wisdom, of ethical wisdom, is virtue. Or, if you like, the ability to do the good. So if artistic wisdom enables us to create beauty, then ethical wisdom enables us to create virtue. Create in the sense of doing it, of becoming virtuous. The next wisdom, you might not like this word. I couldn't come up with any other one, so if anybody has a better one for me, I'm open to it. But I call it philosophical wisdom. Philosophical wisdom. This is the knowledge of causes, of first causes. And I suppose you could say this is the domain of human thought. And that being the case, then what it produces is truth. It perceives truth. Okay, that's philosophical wisdom. It enables us to perceive truth. And then at the pinnacle of it all, way at the top of all the wisdoms, is theological wisdom. Theological wisdom. And the only way I could come up with to describe this is that it's knowledge of the unknowable. It's knowledge. It's the knowledge of God. We've ascended beyond man now. And if mechanical wisdom has to do with practical use, and artistic wisdom has to do with the creation of beauty, and ethical wisdom has to do with the acts of virtue, and philosophical wisdom has to do with the perception of truth, then I would suggest to you that theological wisdom is all of these brought together and made one. It's the symphony of all wisdoms. And what we see here is the fulfillment of Paul's words to the Ephesians that I cherish so deeply, when he says that it pleased the Father. Don't you love that phrase? It pleased the Father. It pleased the Father that in Christ, all things should be made one. All things, including your curriculum. Only Christ can be the Logos. The Logos means that the word for, you know, in the beginning was the Word. The word Word in Greek is Logos, and what it most usually means is the unifying principle of something. Only Christ is big enough to be the unifying principle of everything. Only Christ is big enough that he can bring all things into a harmony without destroying anything, causing everything to flourish. Only he is wise enough. And so this theological wisdom, when all things are made one and brought together, is a wisdom that can only be gained by contemplating Christ and living in him. So that brings up the question, how do we get it? And I've got, how do we get wisdom? I've got four suggestions for you, really a sub-suggestion and then three explicit suggestions, sort of a pre-suggestion, if you like. You can't get wisdom if you don't believe in it. The one bumper sticker I would love to see. Great stoplight conversation. Get wisdom. Right? Because Solomon, while he was driving around Egypt, he saw that on the back of a chariot. So, hey, that's good. So he put it in his collection. Get wisdom. Well, you're not going to go after it if you don't believe in it. Solomon tells us in the Proverbs, and especially in chapter 8, that it's more precious than rubies. There's nothing like wisdom. It'll fill your house with rubies. There is wisdom has hewn out her seven pillars. Wisdom is the most cherished thing. Are you teaching this to your children? Are you teaching them that wisdom is good and beautiful and desirable beyond everything else? Or are you anxiety-driven and worrying about the SAT test? Now, prepare for the SAT test. That would be wise. But don't worry about it. Do you understand? The Scriptures tell us to be anxious for nothing. We are called to rest in Christ. We are called to stay pondering the path of life. The SAT test is one of those mechanisms that drives us off the path of life onto this continual movable path. And notice, it's movable. It's relative. Standards change all the time on the standardized tests. They're movable. Subordinate them to the path of life, I appeal to you. Believe in wisdom first and love it. And how do you get it? One, you open your eyes. Wisdom begins with perception. The mechanical wisdom begins with hearing, seeing, looking. Look. Look at the world around you. Look at the soul within you. Look at the child in front of you. Look at the artwork. Listen to the music. Perceive. Perceive reality. Reality alone is a source of wisdom. Nothing else can give you wisdom. Do you understand that? Only reality can give you wisdom. Okay. So look at real things, contemplate them, think about them, ponder them, and you will be pondering the path of life. This is why you see we paved paradise and put up a parking lot. Second, clean your eyes. You can open your eyes, but if they're scarred and dirtied and can't see, you can't see. And our Lord tells us that the lamp of the body is the eye. If, therefore, the lamp be full of darkness, how great is that darkness? Well, he didn't mean us only to go out and get a pair of glasses. What he's telling us is that if we're going to see truth, the organ doing the seeing is every bit as important as the object being seen. You see, you need to open your eyes because there's a world out there to see. But you also need to keep your eyes clean. And we're talking now, of course, about the eyes of the soul, the eyes of the mind. We need to be purged of our sins. We need to cleanse ourselves. We need to be cleansed by the love of God, by the blood of Christ. We need to be continually cleansing ourselves before him. And that, by the way, is 100 times more important than the curriculum. You can teach and teach, and probably you're driven, since the paths are so movable, you're driven to teach and teach and teach and teach, so that they get good scores and that they get do great on. And then we get frustrated. We're spinning our wheels. Why is it? Why are our wheels spinning? Because we don't take the time to cleanse the soul. If you're teaching a crippled person to run, it's not going to work. So we need to cleanse the soul. We need first to open our eyes, then we need to clean them. And third, once your eyes are clean, if the room is dark, you got to turn the lights on. And I would suggest to you that this is the curriculum. This is the purpose of a curriculum, is to turn on the lights. We've all seen the moments, right? We've all seen the moments when a child perceives something, right? The epiphanies, the moments of enlightenment, the, ah, I get it! Right? That's the lights coming on. This is why math is so important. And don't tell me you're not a math person. You are too. You're in the image of God. You don't dislike math. You dislike not knowing math. Right? So learn what you can. And teach your children what they can learn. One step at a time. Because every time you learn a new thing, every time you learn a new reality, the light goes on. You become enlightened that little bit. And you know what happens? You enjoy God more. I will never forget the moment when I pulled down Euclid's Geometry off my stepmother's shelf and I read the first line. A point is that which has no part. And I thought for a moment and I said, what? And I closed the book and I put it back on the shelf. And that bounced around my mind for 5 years, literally for 5 years. And then one day, I was about 24 years old, and I had done geometry, you understand, in high school. I was about 24 years old, and I think I was lying in bed, and all of a sudden I got it. A point is that which has no part. And I saw it. I perceived it. And literally, my mind has never thought the same again since then. And one way, one benefit was I understood what was happening when Dante reaches the pinnacle of Paradiso in his poetry. Look, if it takes you 5 years to figure out a truth, take 5 years. But what we do in math is we have to keep everybody in lockstep. We have to go through the lessons, right? So we don't contemplate math. We don't dwell on it. We don't let it sink in. And that means that then we change the way we teach it to not contemplating facts about math. Not, first, we, of course, have to memorize the math facts, but not contemplating relationships between numbers. I mean, if you said to somebody today, you have to learn about the nature of numbers, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. Unless you did a math theory class, maybe. We don't contemplate math. We teach it as processes. Processes aren't truth. Processes can enable us to perceive truth, but only if we slow them down enough. The most important, remember the tips I gave you. The first one was ask specific questions of specific people. The second was take your time. Take your time, because that's the fastest way to learn. By the way, it's the only way to learn. You cannot predetermine the amount of time it's going to take a child's soul to absorb the truth. Contemplation is a circular way of teaching, not linear. Do you see? Once the hawk circles the rat enough and strikes it, then go on to the next farm to find the next rat. But we just go, you know, we go from row to row to row. We never make sure the hawk even can eat the rat. So turn on the lights. And what I mean by that in general is contemplate the true, the good, and the beautiful at exactly the level your child is capable of doing it. Math tells us truth. History tells us truth. Literature tells us truth. Okay? And when I say contemplate the good, I'm talking about mechanical, artistic, ethical, philosophical, and theological good. If you read books to your children, please make them good books. Because if you don't, then the form of evil is being presented to them. It may be laziness, it may be discord, whatever it is, evil is being presented to their soul through bad art. Do you understand this? God is a formalist. It says in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth was without what? Form, and it was, or empty, right? And then from verse 2 through verse 28, God creates a form and he fills it. Okay, that's how an artist creates. He gives a form and he fills it, form and content. Starts in Genesis 1. That's how we should teach. And if we don't, if we just rush from process to process, our children won't become wise and their souls will be neglected. So contemplate the good, which is primarily formal. Okay? Contemplate good art and contemplate virtuous behavior. Since it's really hard to be just, let them read about just people. Okay? It's too hard to every day be just in the classroom. So give them just people in history. Okay. Now, I'm going to throw six things at you that I don't want you to do. Okay? These are what not to do to teach, and then I'm going to take 30 seconds to talk about writing. What not to do? One, don't use behavioral approaches to raise your children. Do you know what I mean by behavioral? Your child is an animal, rat through the maze, stimulus response. Sometimes scripted texts are just stimulus response mechanisms. Sometimes they can take away the opportunity to think. Okay, behavioral approaches. Secondly, don't be curriculum driven. I can't say this strongly enough. Don't be curriculum driven. Andrew and I have both developed curricula. We both would appeal to you, I think it's safe to say. Don't be driven by the curriculum. It's a tool, not a master. Don't be driven by the curriculum. And if you go on and use something like a boxed curriculum, I would entreat you not to open the box. Read to your children and talk about it. Okay? If you can't do anything else, read to your children and talk about it. And here's what you should ask your children when you read stories to them, history or literature. If you ask this one question, they will get a liberal education in the best sense of liberal, but just by asking this one question over and over again and then exploring it more deeply. Should he have done it? Should he have done it? When you write, give them writing exercises, teach them to ask the question, should he have done that? Should Washington have crossed the Delaware? Should Edmund have followed the White Witch? Should Brutus have killed Caesar? Should Brutus the Elder have killed Tarquinius Superbus? Should Socrates have left Athens? Should Judas have betrayed Jesus? Should David have had an affair with Bathsheba? Should he have done it? That's the question, by the way, that drives all thinking. I've come to the conclusion that the reason we think and animals don't is because animals never ask should. They calculate, but they don't ask should. So that was my writing instruction. Okay, three last things. I'm going to say them quickly because I'm out of time. One, well, it's my... Of my five things not to do, because I just cut one out, I've got three more, and I'm just going to read them to you. Do not focus on content over ideas. Or if I can put it this way, do not focus on facts over truth. Can't develop that because of time. Second last point, do not focus on production over contemplation. Do not focus on production over contemplation. The checklist doesn't matter. It's the truth that matters. Right? Do not focus on production over contemplation. And finally, do not cover the material. Do you know why? If you cover the material, your students can't see it. You groan, but it's true. Lest thou shouldest ponder the path of life, her ways are movable, that thou canst not know them. Hear me now, therefore, O ye children, and depart not from the words of my mouth. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Do you have questions or comments? Please contact the Institute for Excellence in Writing at 1-800-856-5815 or visit our website, excellenceinwriting.com.